Shrink Wrap Radio number 546, Metacognitive Thinking Skills for Young Students with Hannah Bogan.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Hannah Bogan, co-creator of Brain Talk, a metacognitive curriculum designed to teach students about their brains and how to use the executive function capacities of the prefrontal cortex to respond mindfully rather than react impulsively. For more information about Hannah Bogan, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Hannah Bogan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and I am intrigued by the work that you've been doing, which we'll be going into. But let's start out by having you tell us how you came to be doing the work that you're doing, starting with college.
You bet. So I suppose by official title, I am a speech language pathologist, which means I went to graduate school for speech and language pathology and I happened to go to the University of Washington, an amazing program up in Seattle. I had some of the most brilliant minds teaching me. And interestingly enough, so one component of speech and language development is the social communication piece of how we interact with others. And while that is, of course, a huge part of communication, when you look at it holistically, there isn't a lot of formal education in graduate programs around how to support and treat for social difficulties. But this was inevitably a big interest of mine and an area that I sought out a lot of resources in through trainings, internships on the East Coast with a clinic that specializes in supporting social communication. And as I went down that path, I really found that that the kids who were struggling in developing social communication skills were being given tools as if, you know, think of, you know, how to greet or how to start a conversation, and weren't ever independently using these tools. They didn't really understand the why or the how of what the purpose of these tools were. And that intrigued me, right? How do we help kids understand why they needed to connect with others, and how the tools that we were giving them were going to be useful?
Okay, let me back you up just a moment. Sure. I'm curious about, what was your undergraduate major?
Ah, well, my undergraduate major was political science.
Okay. We're really a diversion then.
Yes, yes. Okay. My original plan was to go to law school. I think at some finite point, I did some good self-reflection and just decided that it wasn't the path for me. And so I did a post-baccalaureate program in Portland and diverted down that path.
Okay. And I can tell that you did go out and seek additional training and got very good training at the University of Washington, because
yes,
the stuff that you're doing, the way that you talk about it, is not what I would normally associate with speech pathology.
No, I would say it's definitely a niche of the field.
Yeah, because you've gotten into a lot of sort of brain-related thinking, mm-hmm, and so on. Now,
yes,
you've been using the term social communication and talking about learning how to greet. It sounds like you're talking about a special population. Who is it you're talking about working with?
Sure. I think initially that special population was kids on the autism spectrum, which, of mm-hmm, course, we now have, you know, this rapidly growing population of folks who are somewhere on that spectrum, who are entering the school world, the workforce, right? So this is something that is an area of significant need in our field. But really, it wasn't just designated to that population of folks, that there are a lot of reasons that somebody might struggle to connect with others socially. And at the end of the day, being able to make social connections is how we are successful, right?
Yeah.
Like it it surpasses your intellect. It surpasses your, even sort of problem solving skills. How we relate to others, I think, really dictates success. And if we think about it through that lens, suddenly the population of individuals who benefit from some additional supports in that arena, it opens right up. So I ended up working directly out of college out of graduate school at a clinic in Oakland that specialized in group therapy for social regulation, emotional regulation, and self-regulation.
With kids,
with preschoolers up through young adults.
Oh,
so my
really?
Youngest okay. kids were, I would say, 4 to 5 at that clinic. My oldest clients were in their late teens, early 20s.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you're doing is teaching what you call metacognitive thinking skills to these kids. So what's meant by that term, metacognitive thinking skills? I mean, that's a big words.
These are big words, and I'll tell you, it's a big term. I'll give you the short answer, and then I'll unpack it a little bit. So if you were to look up metacognition, you will find that this is the process of thinking about your own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And while maybe for someone seemingly complex on the surface, this is a big deal. This involves a lot of different things. It involves your innate ability to understand your strengths and challenges, right? What are you good at? What's hard for you? What do you like? What do you dislike? And how does that maybe push you towards certain activities or interests? And how does it maybe keep you from others?
Yeah, and I'm discovering that evidently this is a hot new topic, this terminology. I think I referred you to a Charlie Rose set of interviews,
yes.
And I'm not sure if you were able to see. Did you find that?
I did.
Oh, good. Yeah, he was doing a roundtable on the brain, and they were looking. Was that in fact relevant to what you're doing? I thought it was.
Absolutely. I think anytime we are thinking about the brain and how the brain is functioning, you are innately building these metacognitive thinking skills.
Yeah, so you're really on the cutting edge. And then after that, you know, I'm also on the board of the online journal, The Neuropsychotherapist.
Yes.
And they just published an article, which I didn't get around to reading. I wanted to in prep for this, but it's using the same terminology. It's a whole article about metacognition. So
yeah.
Evidently, this is a real hot area that you're in.
Yeah, and I'd say what started as a real buzzword in the research and scientific community has very quickly sort of trickled into the educational world, into the therapy world, that we have conferences for teachers, for administrators, for therapists across many domains, certainly not just speech and language, but I'd say across, you know, occupational therapy, educational therapy, I would imagine in the world of psychology, where folks are exploring what it means to back up in our interventions and make sure that we are embedding this foundation of metacognitive understanding for our clients.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, we're handing them tools without a real understanding of why or how to use them.
Yeah. Now, I gather that another piece of this is that it falls under the rubric of self-regulation. That's part of what you're mm-hmm. teaching, right? So why does self-regulation matter in the development of these kids and teens and young adults?
Yeah, this is a great question. So metacognition is directly related to self-regulation because it really is the foundation that those skills are built upon. And self-regulation, right, our ability to regulate, a colleague and I developed our working definition is it's regulating your team, your thoughts and attention, your emotional responses, your actions, and your motivation, okay, your team, in order to meet the social demands or the environmental demands and attain your goals. And this matters for a lot of reasons, but we kind of discovered how relevant it was. And I say we as in the scientific community, back when Stanford published their very well-known marshmallow study, right, back in the late 60s, early 1970s, where they looked at how well young children, preschool age children, could delay gratification. So kids were led into a room and there was a marshmallow sitting on the table. And the researcher says, this marshmallow is yours. You can eat it right now. Or if you wait, I will give you two when I come back. And waiting is the key, right? To delay gratification. And so do you grab and gulp the immediate reward right now? Or can you engage self-regulation to obtain some long-term or ultimate reward? And they followed these kids for years. And what they found was that self-regulation outweighed any other predictor of lifelong success. And this is a big deal, especially when you start talking to teachers and educators and therapists, because you know, we are in the business of helping kids be successful.
Yeah.
And if that is the number one indicator, then we need to figure out how we are explicitly and intentionally teaching self-regulation skills to all kids, not waiting for kids to have some identified deficit or delay that necessitates intervention.
Okay. That's amazing that little test has such huge implications, and the concept of delay of gratification, I mean, that goes all the way back to Freud and psychoanalytic thought. And yet it's so contemporary in this way. And you mentioned autism, but I gather another population that you're working with is ADD and ADHD, right?
Yes, that's a huge, I would say, interestingly enough, the clinic in Oakland where I was working out of grad school started very much weighted towards kids on the autism spectrum who had, I would say, you know, greater difficulties with social engagement than kind of your traditional speech and language disorders, and weighted more by the time I left towards kids with ADHD, whether it was hyperactive and attentive combined, because that difficulty with impulse inhibition, right? Impulse control was so impactful in their ability, their development of social relationships.
Okay.
And school is a social place. So that mattered.
Yeah. And now another one of those high level terms, concepts that you deal with is executive functioning. And evidently that's a big buzzword as well right now. So what is executive functioning and what does it have to do with the self-regulation delay of gratification that we're talking about?
It's so intertwined. So this is a great place to go because the number of times I've walked in with to a school team to consult or do a training or even parents coming to me and I've heard the panicked, I think the child has executive functions. And I have to laugh to myself thinking, yes, I hope that they do, right? Yeah. And I'm pretty sure they do. This is such a buzzword, and yet I think it's really misunderstood for a lot of folks. And so building this understanding is a great place to start. Despite whose model of executive functioning you look at, and there are many out there, pretty much everybody will agree that a general definition is that it is the collective and directive capacities of the brain, right? The conductors of our brain's multiple symphonies that are helping us engage in deliberate, self-directed or goal-directed behaviors.
And I think right now we understand that to be in the frontal or prefrontal area of the brain.
Yeah. Anytime we talk about the brain, we are inherently, you know, we're simplifying it and on some level probably getting it wrong. But talking about it is how we, you know, how we share information. So yes, it kind of lives, if you will, in that prefrontal cortex right behind, if you, you know, put your finger on your forehead and pushed, you're sort of pushing right towards where it would be. But of course, as that area with that kind of houses executive functioning lights up, it's activating all kinds of other areas of the brain to create this conversation within the brain. Now, again, if you're coming at, if you're looking at different research articles, the specific functions that make up executive functioning are going to change depending on whose work you read. So George McCloskey has a different set of functions than Peg Dawson and Richard Guare. Right. And Dawson and Guare, their books and their research has been, I would say, kind of the gold standard of understanding executive functioning in the academic domain. But different folks explain it a little differently. And part of that is because I think we look through different lenses depending on what we do. A neuroanatomist is looking at the brain with different questions than a speech language pathologist or an occupational therapist. But we have all really arrived at the agreement that executive functioning matters, and that it is inherently tied to self-regulation. And so
it has to do with things like for the ability to control our attention.
Yes.
And the ability things to delay gratification and so on.
Things like, you know, again, it depends on whose list you look at, but you're going to see things like planning and prioritizing and set shifting. How can you shift your attention towards one thing to another when the environment necessitates it? Sort of self-modulation, all of these abilities that help us get through multi-step tasks or engage in complex critical thinking. This is what we think of as executive functioning. Now, I work with folks who don't come from the research community, right? So my primary audience are parents and teachers and even other therapists who may not be out actively reading about this stuff. So having a working model of executive functioning that makes sense was a pretty imperative step to take. Mm-hmm. And an absolutely brilliant friend and colleague of mine, Carrie Lindemuth, who's an educational therapist, she and I sort of put together what we call the Oreo cookie model of executive functioning.
Yeah.
And this is based on Russell Barkley's model. So many people know Russell Barkley is kind of the father of understanding ADHD.
So we've gone from the marshmallow to the Oreo cookie.
The marshmallow, so, yep.
I just had to observe that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I may not be so good at delaying gratification when it comes to the sweets. Yeah, so we wanted a way to help folks understand that executive functioning is self-regulation and something else. And that something else is what we call strategic thinking. So if you look at the Oreo model, or if you can conceptualize an Oreo, you've got a layer of cookie, a creamy layer in the middle, and another layer of cookie underneath. Those cookie layers are self-regulation. And that cream in the middle is strategic thinking. Uh-huh. And let's just walk through an example, right? So to help folks understand.
Yeah, say that again. The middle is strategic thinking and the cookies are...
The cookies are self-regulation. So let's use a real life example.
Good.
Let's say I am a 10-year-old student. I'm out at recess and I'm playing basketball with my friends, right? Not lots of kids are in this scenario. And I think that my friend, Marshall, cheated. And now the bell is about to ring. This is an emotionally charged situation if you are 10 years old on the schoolyard. So what do you do? Well, the very first layer of that Oreo is cookie. It's self-regulation. I have to have the self-regulation to inhibit the impulse that I'm feeling. So my impulse may be to do something like pick up the basketball and chuck it over the fence, or push down my friend Marshall because I'm mad, or start screaming or crying, right? All of these impulses that get driven by our emotional center of the brain. If all I do is react in response to a stimulus coming at me, then I'm never engaging critical thinking, right? So first and foremost, the self-regulation to inhibit or pause an impulse. Well, now you've got a paused impulse, you have to make a plan, right? You need a plan for how you're going to respond. That is strategic thinking. Mm-hmm. And that involves know, there's a lot of reasons why somebody can break down at the level of strategic thinking from I actually don't even know how to solve this problem to I have processing delays or working memory deficits, right? We have, whether it's learned difficulties or lack of learning or some real biological reason that this is hard, you know, many kids and adults, in fact, break down at that level. And yet we can teach very well strategic thinking skills. There's a whole field called cognitive strategy instruction that you can look up that is kind of the act of teaching these strategic thinking skills.
So now,
go ahead.
Yeah, so we've taken a step back to really break down sort of micro skills, if you will.
Yes.
That hopefully are learned very early. It makes me think of the importance of preschool, the importance of kindergarten, and all the sort of history of interventions at that level. And it sounds like this work is really substantiating the importance of that.
Yes, in a big way. Yeah. And many kids, right? Anybody who's ever worked with kids or had kids or been in a classroom knows that you can get through that first cookie and that cream layer, and you can coach kids, and you've got this beautiful plan in place, right? So let's say that I am that kid on the schoolyard and I'm able to pause the impulse to react. I come up with a plan. I'm going to ask my teacher if I can have one extra minute of recess to replay, you know, what just happened. That last cookie layer of self-regulation is I have to be able to follow the plan. And again, we can imagine there are a myriad of reasons why kids struggle to follow the plan. I would say a big contributor to difficulties at that level are attention deficits that, you know, I start out on this path and something else gets my attention and now I've shifted away or I've drifted.
Yeah.
Or another impulse comes along and I actually can't pause that one. Or I get hit with an obstacle that I wasn't anticipating and now I feel stalled. So I think most people, even adults, can relate to going through these stages when you're solving or addressing a difficult problem. For kids, they are going through these stages all day long. All day long. We ask a lot of them in the school system. Dare I say, you know, I think school in many ways asks somewhat developmentally inappropriate expectations of these kids. I think we've seen what some would say is a big rise in what look like attention difficulties and impulsivity in the classroom. And part of that may be that our expectations for being able to sit at a table and attend to challenging academics has maybe surpassed what it used to be. And so we need to give kids the skills to be able to be successful in these environments.
Yeah. So I think one of the skills that you teach is attention control. And that begins to emerge into what sounds like mindfulness. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is another yes and. That at some level, our attention controls are an element of the hardware of our brain, right? We have kind of this hardware, what we come to the table with, things like your processing speed, your working memory, your attention control systems that certainly can be improved to some extent, but at some level, the interventions are about learning to compensate for what might not be as effective as the next person. And that hardware supports all these, you know, the software, right? All the skills that we build using those innate capacities. Mindfulness, we know, to the tune of thousands and thousands of studies with adults and children, kind of builds that self-regulation or impulse control muscle of the brain, right? If we picture the brain that way, that choosing to pay attention on purpose in the present moment, and what I think is the hardest part, without judgment, right?
Yeah.
Is helping the brain get better at knowing this thing is important over here. The kids walking by my classroom aren't, or the car driving by isn't the most important thing. or this emotion that's welling up inside of me as I get to know those feelings doesn't have to take over. I don't have to become that emotion. I can pause and make a choice about how to behave in spite of how I might be feeling. And so, yes.
How do you teach mindfulness to little kids?
There's lots of wonderful, wonderful programs and trainings out there that help. You don't have to be an educator, but that help people, I think, learn the skills about adapting mindful exercises for kids. I will admit that there is perhaps some controversy in those who are practicing mindfulness about whether we should be calling those practices true mindfulness, right? Because we aren't necessarily working with kids with the overarching goal of improving or increasing meditation time, which right. Some people say, like, this is an inherent part of mindfulness. Really, we're calling it mindful moments, mm-hmm. right? So it's small moments of directing attention on purpose. So I've seen a little bit more of a movement towards calling this attention direction or attention control training or things like that. But a lot of it has to do with finding small moments throughout the day where we just pause and either listen to the sound of a chime or focus on breathing or begin to notice what our emotional cues feel like. And the Mind Up curriculum is a wonderful resource. Mindful Schools, which is based in Emeryville, Berkeley area of California, does online and in-person trainings to help people learn the skills to teach this to kids. And there's many others. Sitting Still Like a Frog is a great little book with an audio component. There's so many resources out there. So I would encourage folks to explore, something that feels comfortable. If you are working with kids and you want to integrate mindfulness into the work that you're doing.
Are parents accepting of this, or do they, do some have fears that this is some kind of mind control intervention on their kids?
I think far and away parents are accepting and excited and supportive. I have had questions from parents. I remember explaining why we were embedding some mindful practice, mindful moments into some therapy sessions one time. And I said to the parent, we want your child, I kind of laughed. I said, let's go with a simple or an easy approachable definition of mindfulness that that I once had heard. It's the ability to choose how you want to behave every 10 seconds for the rest of your life, was kind of one person's definition. And the parent said, that sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it does.
Right, it does. But I think taking the perspective of, at the time, for her child, who as a teenager communicated in the group, I feel like I am a victim, he called it, of emotional terrorism, which I thought was such a powerful and introspective thing for a teenage boy to come up with, that he felt so hijacked by the strong emotions that he would feel that he didn't have control, right? He was driving the car, the gas pedal felt stuck, he careened into the crowd, and he was left responsible for things that he did and said when he was emotionally triggered that he knew he shouldn't be doing and saying.
This actually happened with the car and all? Yeah.
Oh, no, this didn't. Well, no, I mean.
Is this a metaphor?
Metaphor. Yes, this is the metaphor. This is the metaphorical driving the car and feeling responsible without really, feeling in control.
Yeah.
We talked about, over time, building the brain's ability to pause impulses so that he could activate all those great strategic thinking skills that we had been teaching.
Now, you're talking about working with teens. Is there a certain age that you actually talk to kids about their brain and how their brain works and teaching them about that? And is that helpful knowledge? Can it translate into behavior and experience?
I think it's incredibly helpful. I would say it's kind of a soapbox that I get on top of that. To me, I think one of the most important ways that we build metacognitive thinking skills, right, thinking about your own thinking, is by teaching about the brain and how the brain works. And I would argue that you can do it at any age. You just simplify how you're talking about it. So take a preschool population, just bringing awareness to the fact that we have a brain. And I think focusing on the seeking or avoiding tendencies of the brain is something that even at that young age, kids can grasp, right? They know that they like certain things and dislike others, that something feels comfy and some things feel uncomfy. And they can begin to kind of categorize what feels comfy in my life and what feels uncomfy. Well, you know, at a more scientific level, we could substitute comfy and uncomfy for what is your brain seeking, right? What is the limbic system or your emotional sort of survival system of the brain pushing you towards, and what is it avoiding? What does it think is threatening and therefore generating this big fight, flight, or freeze impulse to try to keep you safe? And as kids get older, I think, you know, the way that the complexity with which we talk about the brain can adjust to their developmental levels.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of this.
Yeah. And I've interviewed a number of neuropsychotherapists. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a regular feature of their practice, is educating people about the brain, which I guess has the effect of moving it out of being a moral problem of, you know, you're bad, right?
Yes.
You're bad because you do this or that, and putting it, well, this is how your body is working, and you know, and that's where this is coming from, and you can make some changes.
Yes. Yeah, that externalization piece is I think critical when you are really when you're supporting anybody, but especially if you're working with, let's say, a child or a teen who has a history of being unsuccessful, right? So a lot of kids that I ended up working with therapeutically were having a difficult time making connections with peers, not today or yesterday, but for years, right? Like their pattern was, I am unpredictable, impulsive, and unsuccessful, and I don't know how to be successful in these social situations. And there were many reasons that that was the case, but this is where they ended up. And they were so connected to that feeling of being unsuccessful that we needed to give them some space from it. They were never the problem. No child, I really believe this, the child is not the problem, right? Ross Green, who is the author of The Explosive Child, a wonderful resource, I think, for a lot of people in the therapy field, says kids do well if they can. And if they're not doing well, there's a mismatch between their capacity and the demands being placed on them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we have to do is help kids get come and sit on our side of the table with the problem or the problematic behavior on the other side of the table. And I think we do that by giving language or a label to what the problematic behavior is, right? You having a fight impulse or a flight or freeze impulse to the spelling quiz being put in front of you doesn't make you bad. It means, and I would call it, it means you're having a MIG moment. It means your amygdala is triggered, right? That part of your brain, your threat detector, saw that spelling quiz, anticipated it, and I mean this very literally, as a threat to the survival of your species, and generated this huge impulse because it's trying to keep you alive. And I'll say to kids, there's nothing wrong with your brain. It's just doing its survival job a little too well. So we're going to help tame or calm down those parts of the brain that think that you need to be surviving when really everything is okay. So I think it's giving kids that perspective to be able to talk about it. And most of us feel better when we can label something. So Daniel Siegel, who is, I know you've interviewed Daniel Siegel, who is just an absolute inspiration for me professionally, in The Whole Brain Child, which is a book that, you know, I think countless parents and teachers have read and found useful. One of his strategies is name it to tame it. And this is exactly what he's talking about. Give these abstract emotional experiences a name so that we can start to manage or address or, you know, change them, so that the child can be more successful and regulated.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And having interviewed him twice, I wasn't aware of that part of his work. I guess he's doing an awful lot. So you've developed your own metacognitive program. Maybe you can tell us about that and how it came into being.
Sure. That program is called Brain Talk. And it came into being, I think, like many therapy programs do, not because my, again, this brilliant friend and colleague of mine, Carrie Lindemuth, we co-developed and created this, and not because either of us sat down and thought, let's make a curriculum. In fact, that was the last thing that we had any desire to do because we both had full-time jobs and busy lives. But I would say it fell into being, if you will. I was working with a delightful young lady, an adolescent girl who had significant social anxiety. And I felt like a terrible therapist because I remember throwing every tool I knew of her way, right? I would teach her something. I'd give her this tool. Let's work on this. And nothing was resonating. And it was getting to that point where I didn't even know if I should ethically continue working with her because I just didn't feel like I was able to connect and help her. And I went into a session with her one day. This was not a group session. This was just one-to-one. And I remember thinking, forget it. Enough with the tools. I'm just going to talk about the brain with her. So I started by explaining about the amygdala and we started to talk about it. I said, oh, it actually means little almond, in Latin because it looks like a little almond in your brain. And of course, to a 10-year-old girl, amygdala was very complex, right? She couldn't remember the name. So we said, you know, let's just call it MIG. And when your MIG senses a threat, we'll call that a MIG moment. And I said, what do you think your MIG moment looks like when one of your classmates says hi to you? Do you think that you have the fight impulse, right? You want to yell at them or argue with them? Do you think you have flight? You want to try to get away as quick as you can? Or do you think you have a freeze, like you just shut down? And all of a sudden, it just opened up this communication with her that suddenly we were talking about something that felt separate from her, but connected enough that she was able to really go down that path. And so I remember mentioning this to my friend, Carrie. We were on a walk one day and Carrie said, well, what if we made characters for other important parts of the brain? And that's really how Brain Talk was born. And it was, you know, very much a homegrown, it has been a really homegrown project that evolved over a year into whiteboard animated videos that admittedly we still to this day, I mean, we created them, but I couldn't actually tell anybody how to make a good whiteboard animated video. But it has lesson plans that go as young as, you know, early elementary, so at the kindergarten level, all the way up through middle and high school, and then a therapy model. And our goal was, you know, for someone who doesn't get excited about reading, you know, research about the hippocampus at night, like Carrie and I do, how do we create something for them where they get enough background that they understand how to talk about this with students, but it isn't overwhelming, right? It's still manageable.
Yeah.
And so,
are some other of these brain characters that you guys have developed? This is at a level that I can grasp.
There you go. So in the limbic system, which is your sort of your feeling brain, we We have MIG, who is your amygdala. This is your threat detector, right? Your brain's alarm system. And then we developed Buster. And Buster is representative of the basal structures, your pleasure and reward circuit, right? So Buster resonates with a lot of the kids I work with who have maybe ADHD, that hyperactive brand where they are, we call it having a grab and gulp impulse. So instead of a MIG moment, Buster gives you a Buster bam. And the impulse that you feel is your seek impulse, right? It is, I need to grab and gulp whatever this is as quickly as possible before it disappeared. Oh. And the problem with that, remember, let's go back to the delayed gratification, is that if you grab and gulp something right now that keeps you from getting a better ultimate reward in the future, then you are reacting, right? You're not inhibiting your impulses appropriately. So those were our two kind of seek and avoid systems made into characters. And then we felt like talking about the hippocampus was critically important for students. And the hippocampus we personify as the librarian of your brain, right? We call it Miss Hip. And Miss Hip keeps track of all of your personal memories. And we tell kids she or it keeps track of your past patterns. So your past is an acronym. The people, actions, space, and time of a situation. And as you get enough of these past, you know, scenarios sort of mapped in your memory, you can look for patterns. And you can notice, gosh, every time I hang out with, you know, Jessica, I get triggered in this way. Or every time I'm at Trader Joe's on a Sunday night, right, I feel triggered. I have a MIG moment. So you know, it was through those understanding those limbic structures, we were trying to give kids a sense of control and understanding over where their impulses were coming from. And so that's where we went with the limbic system. Now, of course, the brain, we are humans. We are not just doers or reactors, we have a thinking brain. So we wanted to go on and personify that as well, the prefrontal cortex. And so the prefrontal cortex is the professor. Mm-hmm. And the professor is who helps your brain make plans and weigh the options in communication with MIG and Buster and Miss Hip in order to come up with the best plan of action for how to behave.
Yeah. Well, wow, this really makes it very concrete and brings it down to earth for kids. I had planned to ask you, you know, if I were a fly on the wall, what would I see you doing? You know, we've heard all these abstract concepts, but sure. But I have a much clearer sense of what we might see.
Yeah, and the hope is I think it's Brain Talk's been out for about a year, and it's certainly, I wouldn't want anyone listening to think that it is the only option for teaching kids about the brain. There are other phenomenal resources that are out there. I think Carrie and I were in our quest to look for something that married understanding the brain with sort of introducing or creating a nice foundation for mindfulness tools and for creating a foundation to talk about all those strategic thinking and plan making skills. We just didn't find the resource that we were looking for. So we thought, I guess we'll make it. But you know, I think always the hope when it comes to teaching about the brain is that you want the average teacher to be able to pick this up and be weaving this into their classroom. I always laugh and say, if I ruled the world, right?
Yeah.
We would be teaching these metacognitive skills. We'd be teaching kids about the brain, developing this sort of cognitive behavioral understanding in K through 12 general education for every single individual. That I think it is a travesty that we wait until people are in crisis to give them this information because there's no downside. Nobody is harmed, right? The person who was just going to figure it out anyway is not going to be harmed by learning this information. And in fact, might do better, right? It might help them manage anxiety down the road or, you know, or a difficulty down the road to have this, to be armed with this knowledge about how their brain works.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking back to Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
And it seems like they were doing some of this.
Yes. And I love that you mentioned both of those. It's so timely. So in fact, Sesame Street has an entire new series of videos that star none other than Cookie Monster. And they are rated, it cracks me up, SC for self-control. And it's a whole series of little short videos. Most of them are parodies, by the way, of movies or shows that adults would know, that are all about Cookie Monster using strategies to develop self-regulation skills. So there's the Sesame Street connection.
Yeah.
And Mr. Rogers, there's a show called Daniel Tiger that a lot of folks who work with preschoolers know of. Daniel Tiger is the was sort of Mr. Rogers reborn, if you will, reincarnated.
Yeah.
as a cartoon for younger kids, an animated show that is focused on providing some emotional vocabulary and trying to develop early emotional regulation skills for kids. So isn't it funny that the two shows that that I think resonate for you from your own past have not gone anywhere and in fact are being reinvented to highlight how important these skills are for kids.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to hear that because we had four children and they, those two shows were important to our kids. And my wife, who's an educator, she really honed in on the value, particularly of Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
She's very impressed by by the way he would talk to kids, and they would really have the sense that he was their friend and he was talking directly to them and telling them things about the world and how it works.
I think Mr. Rogers did a really nice job of just in the delivery of the themes. And I think there's other, you know, programs and people who've done this about helping folks understand that emotions are not good and bad. Right. This is something that really matters to me, that we change the conversation from emotions being good or bad or positive or negative to they're comfortable or uncomfortable. I mean, anyone can tell you that sometimes feeling angry is really comfortable. And it might be because, you know, they're seeking that intense sensory input, right? That feels good. It's feeding something that the brain needs in that moment. Or, you know, it might be for some other reason, but there's nothing inherently bad about what we would probably label as the uncomfortable emotions. They're messengers. They tell us important information. And so that's something that I think belongs in these metacognitive conversations, which is getting to know your emotions and sometimes getting a little more comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So that they don't take over. So you are not hijacked by those strong emotions.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing wonderful work. All of this sounds very exciting to me.
Thank you.
And you seem so young to be doing this.
Well, you know, when you're passionate about something, you do it. You find ways to contribute.
Yeah.
I think from day one, I wanted to feel like there was something that I added to my field. And admittedly, I love reading research. And I remember really debating whether I was going to go the more research driven PhD route of speech language pathology. Unfortunately, we don't have a clinical PhD. But I think at the end of the day, this is how I'd love to make my mark. And, you know, of course I'm a therapist, but really, I think my true passion is in partnering with schools, school teams, and teachers, because the people who are with these kids day in and day out are teachers, they're educators.
Yeah.
And so the more we arm those individuals with the knowledge of the brain, the importance of developing metacognitive thinking skills, the importance of teaching, explicitly teaching self-regulation skills, I think the more successful the kids are and the more successful the teachers are.
That well, I get that fun. You're a real crusader, and and I think that you could have a big impact on this field, and how you'll best do it, I don't know whether that will be getting a PhD and becoming a professor or writing a book or developing a film series or just doing what you're doing, lots of workshops all over the place. But I really want to encourage you to move in that direction. I can just sense that you have important things to say and can be very impactful. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate
having said that, I'm wondering if there, as we wind down here, if there's anything more that you want to say that maybe you didn't get a chance to cover.
Gosh, I would really just leave listeners with the, I guess, the message that I know a lot of this I've talked about today has been geared towards kids, but this isn't just about kids. I think these skills and taking the time to step back and think about your own thinking, to learn about your brain, to develop, if you will, a relationship with your emotions, and to notice the kinds of things that trigger strong emotional responses. These are the skills that matter to anybody, young or old. And so if you're wondering where to start with yourself. Start with yourself, because the more regulated we are as adults, the more regulated we can help the kids and the youth around us be.
Well said. And so, Hannah Bogan, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
This conversation with Hannah Bogan put me in mind of my early days in a clinical psychology program at the University of Michigan. I spent one of my summers there as a counselor at the university's Fresh Air Camp for Emotionally Disturbed Boys. The philosophy of treatment was expressed in a 1965 book of that time by Fritz Radl and Dave Weinman titled Children Who Hate, a sensitive analysis of the antisocial behavior of children in their response to the adult world. As I recall, Fritz Radl was a Detroit-based psychoanalyst, and Dave Weinman was a psychologist and director of the Fresh Air Camp at that time, located appropriately enough in Hell, Michigan. I kid you not. As I recall, the approach was based on a psychoanalytic understanding that these kids, mostly from inner-city Detroit, suffered from bottled-up rage and poor impulse control. The idea was to give them a week-long experience in the country to get a sense of a better, alternative world out there and to teach them to talk things through. One thing that might be controversial today, I'm not sure, was when they would have an emotional explosion, we counselors were to get them in the Fresh Air Camp, quotes, hold, which involved grasping their wrists from behind with their arms crossed over their chest, in effect putting them in a firm, secure restraint, somewhere between a hug and a straitjacket. And they would struggle mightily against it, by the way. But eventually they would settle down and be reasoned with. I just now decided to Google it, and the University of Michigan Fresh Air Camp is still going, having started in 1937. So it's interesting to me to learn about Hannah Bogan's work and that of others who are approaching these issues from a more brain-oriented perspective. I'm hoping that people around the world have access to the interview series with Charlie Rose. He leads televised roundtable discussions with amazing guests from many different fields, politics, the arts, and the sciences. He's done several brain series, co-hosting them with Columbia professor and Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel, MD. About a week ago, there was an episode in this series that dovetails very nicely with Hannah Bogan's work. It focused on ways the brain can be impacted both negatively and positively in the early years. I had the impression that program might be of particular interest to Hannah and recommended it to her, and she was able to find it and agreed that it was very relevant to her work. I had some difficulty getting the names of the panel from that Charlie Rose show. However, I did learn that it is episode number 5 from series 3 on the brain. Maybe that will help you find it. Also, there was a Deborah Simpson, I think that was her name, on bullying, a Charles Nelson from Harvard Medical School, a Ken Dodge from Columbia, a Kimberly Noble, and Michael Mead from McGill. I'm not sure I got these names right, but I'm hoping that they may help you to find the episode I'm talking about. The focus, as I say, was on the effects of childhood adversity on the brain. Hannah's Brain Talk materials are available by subscription to educators and therapists. She may start advertising it on our site. In the meantime, relevant professionals may want to contact her through her website at www.hannahbogan.com. And Hannah Bogan is spelled HannahBogen.
Hi, this is Dr. Ralph Wilson. I wanted to let you know that I'm so impressed with your work that I'm literally, I tell every patient I see that they ought to log into shrinkwrapradio.com and get the latest and anything that's concerning what's going on in their life. You can find almost anything at Shrink Wrap Radio. And thanks for being there, Dave. I won't let you take a whole lot longer on this spot, but thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye for now.
Thank you, naturopathic Dr. Ralph Wilson, who has been a longtime supporter of the show. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Dr. Wilson's call to action? The fact that professionals of his caliber are so enthusiastic about Shrink Wrap Radio should bring home to you the value of the show and the merits of becoming a supporter. From time to time in the past couple of months, I've heard from listeners who said they weren't able to leave comments in the comments area on the site because they got timed out. This was especially for long comments. I believe we have now fixed that problem. So please do leave your comments about individual episodes in the comments area on the site under that particular episode. If by any chance you do get timed out, do let me know so that I'll know the problem still exists. I hope it doesn't, but I do need to know. If that does happen to you, by the way, email that comment to me and I'll post it on the site and attribute it to your name. Again, I want to let you know that I'm also posting each episode to the Internet Archive so that they will be available into the distant future. And you can find all our episodes there at https://archive.org/details/shrinkwrapradio. Go ahead and check it out. You might recall my interview with life coach Mark Susnow on episode number 544, Cultivating a Life Inspired by Possibilities. Well, you might enjoy listening to his interview with me on his podcast, The Inspire Possibility Show. The focus of our discussion was my ideas and experiences in relation to synchronicity. I said some things I don't believe I've said elsewhere. You might find it interesting. It's a half-hour show, and I've put a link to it, which you can find by going to shrinkwrapradio.com and then click on the In the Media tab, and currently you'll see it right at the top of the list there.
Hi, this is Hannah Bogan, speech-language pathologist, social cognitive specialist, and co-founder of Brain Talk, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Well, thank you, Hannah Bogan, who was today's guest. Here's a recent email from our listener community. It comes from Dan, who writes, Dr. Dave, I would like to recommend someone else for an interview. Peter and Jamie Faust in Belmont, Massachusetts, have blended Bert Hellinger's work with Ralph Meltzer's and others to create some of the deepest work I've done. I just attended another seminar this past Saturday and was reminded about their talent and expertise. Here's their website, and he gives www.constellationapproach.com. He goes on to say, I have worked with Peter individually for 10 plus years, including some premarital work with my then soon-to-be wife. My wife and I have seen Jamie to work on some issues when my daughter was born, and I have attended several of their Constellation seminars, which have been consistently exceptional in depth and quality of work they do. Peter and I continue to meet sporadically. Given the mix that they bring to their work, I thought an interview with them would be very interesting. I did ask for their permission before sending this, and they consented. As an aside, Peter leads the graduate group of the Hero's Journey Men's Program, Michael Mirvash's work. Peter is how I found out about that work. Thank you, and hoping all is well with you. And that's signed Dan. Well, Dan, I think that's an excellent suggestion. I haven't had a chance to go to the website yet, but you know how impressed I am with Michael Mirvash's work, and so this is something I will definitely take into serious consideration. And I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Hannah Bogan, for sharing her work on teaching metacognitive thinking skills to young people in need of them. Next week, my guest will be Paul Gilbert, PhD, about his pioneering work in the area of compassion-focused psychotherapy. He's been requested by several listeners, and I've been trying to get him on the show for some time. So, be there. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.